copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So let's begin with an easy question. Why talk about sex? Well, I will let Groucho Marx answer the question for us. I think sex is here to stay. So, it will not go away. So we better deal with it. Sex is powerful, exciting, wonderful, and troublesome and very hurtful part of human existence. And one cannot be a human being without thinking about and try to have an understanding about and make a lot of choices related to sex. So of course we need to do some good thinking about sex. And if you are Christians, I like this this quote from an American theologian. We should not be ashamed to discuss what God was not ashamed to create. So if there is a creator God who has created this universe, it is an obvious fact that sex was first in his mind before it became a reality in our world. And he thought about it and he didn't blush. But obviously thought, oh, this is a good idea to make physical beings, bodily beings, with sexuality in all its dimensions. So as Christians, we have no reason whatsoever to be silent about this area or leave it as something only for the individual to reflect over. But we need to talk about it. Of course, there is deeply personal sides, and we need to make good choices what we share with whom, also in discussions. But generally, we should not be ashamed to discuss what God was not ashamed to create. So I hope we will have a good afternoon with openness in terms of really trying to understand this aspect of God's created reality. Just a short remark about the distinction between the moral and the legal. I will not discuss very much legal issues, what kind of laws we should have in our different countries. We might come into it at the end in relationship to same-sex marriage and legislation. But generally, this will be an afternoon about ethics, about morality, which is not identical to law, of course. All laws should be moral, but all morals should not be put into laws. There's a lot of things that should not be regulated in laws, but they are still important for human beings to take a stand on. So I will be discussing mainly the moral issue, not what we should put into our laws. Also, just as a perspective from before we start to wrestle with the issue, every time when we are dealing with moral issues, we are faced with a dilemma that all human beings since the fall have had to live with. And that is the contrast between moral ideals and the factual reality of our lives. And there will be a tension. Nearly all people I've met in my whole life have agreed on the principle, you should not lie. And if I then ask them, have you lied? everyone is agreeing that they have lied. So they agree on an ideal, we should be tell the truth, and then they agree that they have lied and fallen short of the ideal they affirm. So in all areas we have to deal with what to do with this tension between the ideal and reality. And it is like that in terms of sexuality. Now when I look at churches in Sweden, and I think it is similar in other places, I think I see two pitfalls, two ditches we can fall into. When we are confronted with the tension between ideals and reality, one way to solve that tension is, of course, to lowering the ethical bar and get rid of the tension by formulating the ideal so it fits to the factual reality. And in terms of sexual ethics in, for example, the Lutheran Church in Sweden, that is what has been going on for the last 3 or 4 decades, lowering the ethical standard until it fits how the population actually lives. Okay, so it creates a smooth situation. There is no tension, but there is not much of ethics left any longer. The other way to solve the problem, which is much more common in what we calls the free churches, and more the traditional, more Bible-believing churches, that is hypocrisy and harshness. That you hide the discrepancy between the ideal and reality, and everyone pretends that we live up to the ideal. And the really serious thing is if you are disclosed as a sinner, then people are really hard and you are just pushed away. Now, that's not very beautiful either. With hypocrisy. Now, the gospel solution is, of course, very different. It's neither of these two solutions. The gospel solution is that we acknowledge the gap between ideals and reality, and we ask for God's forgiveness. So it's God's grace that covers our sins, and it's God's Spirit that sanctifies us and helps us to start to walk in the light and walk according to God's will. So it's the grace of God and the Spirit of God, it's forgiveness and sanctification that must be the gospel solution to this discrepancy. So I would like you to keep that in mind when I continue to talk here, where I will in a few minutes start to describe the ideal. But let's take a broader picture. If we look at humanity, what kind of perspectives on sex do we find? Of course, huge numbers. But I think they can be formed mainly into 4 different groups. A number of cultures have had a very negative view towards sex, suppressing or ignoring the body and the sexual, like in the Greek dualism, where you are looking at the body as something low or something evil or something non-important, and where sex is, of course, acknowledged for its function to procreate, but you should try to ignore it and not look at it from other perspective. It's for procreation, that's it. So that leads to a kind of suppressed view on sexuality. Other cultures have moved in the other direction and tried to get rid of as many taboos as possible, a kind of boundless sexuality, where it's very important to express yourself sexually, but where the main perspective will be not so much the meaning of sex and the quality of sex, but the amount of sex and the quantity of sex. Some cultures have made a close connection between God and sex. So, sex is one way to approach God. And religious ecstasy and orgasm should go together. Like in Hindu tantric sex, where you have this connection between sex and the divine. And you can think of all the cultures with cult prostitution, where sex and religion is merged. And then you combine two very powerful forces within the human being, and together it's kind of dangerous. And some cultures, they have tried to have a more balanced view on sex, where they have said, here is an area where sex should flourish, where it's good, it's right, but there are boundaries. Outside this area, sex becomes destructive and immoral. Of course, they do not always agree on the exact area, but the thinking is sex is good in certain places, but not in other. And you then try to define the area where sex is to be affirmed and seen as something really good. Thinking of my own country, Sweden, historically we have had a kind of mixed between a balanced Christian informed view and a suppressed view of sexuality. So a kind of mixture. Now we're moving really fast up in this direction, and a few people experiment with this, but the general trend is to try to get rid of as many taboos as possible. The amount of sex, not the quality or the meaning of sex, is the focus. This direction has been going on since the 60s, and Sweden has taken the lead in the sexual revolution. So it's interesting for me as a Swede to look at my own country. What has happened? What has happened? And what is the consequences of the sexual revolution? So let's make a quick case study of Sweden. And what I will say about Sweden goes for most of Europe. Of course, nationally, there are a lot of differences, but the general trends are similar in many, many countries in Europe and the whole Western world. So for a number of decades now, people have aimed for a new freedom, getting rid of the limitations that culture previously put on sex. Basically, freedom from the Christian understanding of sex, where sex was related to marriage and to commitment and to children and to procreation. And the whole mentality is to break free from that kind of understanding. The big question is, of course, you can break free from one understanding, but what is your new understanding? You have one perspective and you dismiss it, but with what do you replace it? And that is, to some degree, still an open question. Most people are still in the process of rejecting the old perspective more than formulating the new. How would the new perspective really look like? If I look at my own culture and try to, you know, walk around my own culture and look at it from different perspectives, this is what I see. We have gradually moved from a sexual ethics of commitment, lifelong marriage, for better or worse, until death do us apart. So that was the ideal. To an ethics of closeness, where people have a series of relationships that are marked by love and compassion for each other, as long as we feel this love for each other. And then we have moved to an ethics of pleasure, lust and mutual enjoyment, friends with benefits. Now, that is a very radical change of an ethics of commitment to an ethic of lust and mutual enjoyment. 16, 17 years old, it's very common to have friends with benefits. So people have sex with friends. There's nothing of love or commitment. Another way of looking at what has happened is to say sexuality, there are at least three basic aspects to sexuality. There is the uniting aspect of two bodies, and more than that, two persons being united, becoming one, illustrated in the sexual act. There is procreation, to multiply, new human beings coming into being. And there is, of course, when it's done in the right way, pleasure and passion and enjoyment and excitement. Well, that's the three basic aspects of sexuality. What we have done in our culture is, to a very large degree, totally ignored the two first. Not that we not know of them, but we just ignore them. We don't take into account that a sexual act, there is a uniting aspect between two persons. And we totally ignore that there come children after having sex. Nearly 40,000 abortions in my little country is, of course, proof of that. We just ignore the fact that sex is related to procreation. And we think of sex just from one aspect. It's pleasure, it's passion, it's enjoyment, it's excitement. A third way to look at sex is to say, we have actually done male sexuality as the norm for both males and females. Traditionally, in the past, women were called to be chaste, and then there was more freedom for men. Oh, they have such a strong sex urge, they cannot help it. Much more of that attitude. And women were there to regulate sexuality, so it did not went wrong. Now, women are strongly encouraged to pursue sex like men has always done. So the solution to the inequality, which was of course a very ugly perspective, to give a free card to men and give the responsibility to women, the solution to that is to say women should do like the men traditionally has done. Which in my view means that in both cases, fallen male sexuality becomes the norm, the standard. And believe me, I'm a male with a fallen sexuality. It's not the best solution to make our sexuality the norm. The alternative no one is talking about, an alternative solution, is of course to encourage men to be responsible, or to put it even better, to encourage both men and women to grow in self-control, which, by the way, is one of the fruits of the Spirit. That both men and women grow in self-control and act sexually in a responsible way. A few years ago, the Swedish equivalent to the Time magazine had a whole issue on the sexual revolution. And they had a very interesting article where they said, baby boomer talked about it, those born in the 80s implement it. And that's about the sexual revolution. The baby boomers talked about it in the 60s, those born in the 80s implemented it. And here's their proof for that. And this is the statistics from Sweden. People in late adolescence or around age 20, on average, have more sexual partners per year than the corresponding group in the 60s had in a lifetime. So the real revolution is taking place now, not in the 60s. More sexual partners in a lifetime when you are 20 years old, per year when you're 20 years old, than your parents had during their whole lifetime. Let me give you some statistics. I will not go into details, but just a general picture. The sexual revolution, what's the consequences? And I will just mention a number of areas related to sex. The divorce rate. 1950, there were 54,000 marriages and 8,000 divorces in Sweden. 2013, there were 47,000 marriages, even though our population is much, much, much larger now. And 27 divorces. Huge difference. In the last national, really big survey on sex, and in Sweden we have statistics on everything, there will come out a new national survey in a year's time, but 96 is the latest really national for the whole population survey in Sweden. Unfaithfulness among married or or people cohabitating, then 38% of the men were unfaithful and 23% of the women. So they are married or living together with someone but have had sex with someone else during that time. If you look at the sexually transmitted disease, they are skyrocketing. 33% of people in the age between 25 and 49 have had a sexually transmitted disease, and that's 96. Since then, all the figures have gone up. Chlamydia increased with 239% between 97 and 2007, in 10 years' time. So it's just epidemic. Some of you mentioned prostitution. 1996, 14% of the men said they had visited prostitutes. My guess is that that will be higher in the next survey in Sweden. Abortion, over 35,000, between 35 and 40,000 abortions a year. One of four pregnancies ends in an abortion. Now, this is just a lot of figures and statistics. But if you start to reflect about it, there is so much pain behind those figures. There's a lot of individuals with sadness in their lives. 2005, there were a national survey amongst young people. And when they summarized the general trends, there were two overall trends amongst young people in Sweden. And they say, the change can be interpreted as one, since a number of decades ongoing dissolution of the romantic love complex governing our intimate relationships. This dissolution is visible both in a change of love ideology, the ideology that links sexuality with love, and in a change in critique of heteronormativity, the heterosexual relationship as the normal and natural starting point. So the two most visible changes going on is the separation between love and sex, and then the critique of the heteronormative perspective, that there is that you should in some sense prefer the male-female relationship. And both trends are the two growing trends. If you look at the legal and criminal side of what's happening, you will again see a very sad situation. Increase in reported crimes between 89 and 98, sexual offense increasing 50%, against person under 15 years increased 61%, rape increased 36% in terms of reported cases. Increase in reported rapes. Just the year 2002, it increased 12%. 2006, it increases 65% in Stockholm, 54% in the country. Now, a lot of people are saying, well, this is not real increases, it's just people are more willing to report. And I'm sure that's one factor, because those very depressing figures. But I'm also quite sure it's not the only factor, but that there is also a real increase in sexual violence. And the police reports about that, police officers who have been working for several decades, are reporting an increase in the violence they see. It was very interesting on Twitter. 2010, one of the biggest Twitter storm was a hashtag called Talk About It. And it was a woman who sent a tweet about the gray zones where we have done something that was not really okay. It was not rape, it was not openly violent, but it was still over some border, and we need to talk about it. And it just exploded with people saying, I've been a victim of that, or I myself had gone over a line, and we need to talk about it, because we are hurting each other. 2012, one of the biggest Twitter thing was a hashtag unrecorded, which were women who had been raped and not reported it. So one woman said, I was raped and I did not have the courage to report it to the police at the time. And Twitter just exploded with women having the same experience. You see where I'm going with this. The sexual revolution has not created a very happy population. We have not freed ourselves from something terrible in order to become free and joyful and, you know, found really a new good way to deal with sexuality. Just a final thing. I have three big articles here in Swedish from the most well-known sex advisors in media who answers people questions about sex. And they say, one very common question today is that people write in, and even men write in saying, I have lost my sex urge, my sex drive, my lust. When he does not want to have sex, this becoming a problem. Here's the most well-known sex advisor in Sweden saying, every second letter I receive is about this. It's like, on the one hand, we are crazy about sex. On the other hand, for a number of people, we are overdoing the thing and we are losing sex. So here's my conclusion with this part. Our sexual lifestyle leads to much pleasure, I'm not denying that. Gifts from God, God's creation, is filled with wonder even if you use it the wrong way. So I'm not denying that there is a lot of pleasure and joy. But there is also immense pain in relationship to sex. The sexual revolution is not only a positive liberation, but also humiliation and debasement. And I would say it is a failure even from a utilitarian perspective, just trying to get the most pleasure. It's a failure even from a utilitarian perspective. We really need a better way. I don't think we in the Western world have solved the sexual issue. On the contrary, we are in the wrong way. And I think there are plenty of signs for that. So it's, in some sense, a good situation to bring sex back into the discussion. We need to discuss it because we are hurting ourselves the way we are living today. Okay, just give you a chance for if you have a reaction or question at this moment, or a comment. Yes?
You had a figure up earlier about faithlessness. People were not faithful with them, and you had figures up there. You didn't distinguish between people who were playing away, who were faithless without their partner knowing, and those relationships where, which are open relationships where they have other partners but stay together.
Mm.
Are you with me?
Yeah, yeah.
What they call monogamish relationships. Would the figures have been different if you distinguished between the two?
Slightly. So the question is about marriages and people living together, and I had statistics about the unfaithfulness, that there were no distinction between unfaithfulness in secret and those who have open marriages where they have given each other that freedom. Now, I don't have the statistics. My hunch is that the number of open marriages are quite few, but I don't have the statistics. So in the survey, it was a general question. Are you married or cohabitating? And then have you ever been unfaithful to your partner during the time you were married?
Mm-hmm. Now we're moving, the sexual revolution has moved us on. So
yeah.
My guess is a significant proportion of gay marriages, for instance, will be open marriages.
Yeah.
Quite deliberately. And that may not be true for heterosexual marriages, but certainly be true for gay marriages.
That is true. So
the culture has moved on.
Yeah, yeah. The whole issue of gay marriage will change a number of things here. Yeah, it will.
If one writes into newspapers in Sweden, for example, kind of critiquing this, do the papers publish it? And if they do, what's the reaction? Do you have any comment on that?
There's been very little critique. There's constantly coming figures which you would expect would raise questions about the way we are living. But since the sexual revolution is one of the few holy values we have in our society, it's not questioned. So generally, it's been very silent about this. Yes?
So you showed on your PowerPoint 14% of people have visited prostitutes, whatever you call them. Can you give us a little bit information what are the backgrounds of those prostitutes? Like the person who kind of get money from the sex. Also, I'm curious about their sexual, their religious background, also their nationality. Are they Swedish or Sweden? They're from Sweden or they're from different country who live in your land and they earn money from sex.
So this is about prostitution in Sweden and if the prostitutes are Swedes or if it's people from other countries. It's both, but unfortunately, Sweden is there's a lot of trafficking victims in Sweden. So women from other countries being forced to come to Sweden and selling sex there. Now it's in Sweden it's illegal with prostitution, and it means that the visible prostitution is not that big, but it's much of an underground through the internet. Business. So some of the statistics is harder today than before because of this this law forbidding prostitution or forbidding to buy sex. You're not forbidden to sell sex, but you are criminalized if you are buying sex. That's the Swedish law.
Do you have any idea about their religions?
No. No. Yes?
So I come from a background of statistics, so I'm going to ask you for a couple more. You've not talked about the consequences on length of relationship, which perhaps even is a false term when we're talking between friends. But I wonder if you've got, because I've heard statistics like, so the common lie that if you have sex before marriage and then you get married, you're likely to have tested each other out better. It's actually statistically proven to be false. Those marriages last less time than those that wait until marriage. And I wondered, given that you're throwing statistics at us, whether you have any statistics on these types of things.
So it's a question about stability and length of marriage in terms of premarital sex. I actually have some statistics on that. I will come back to that. A last question, Alexander.
I had several questions, but let me just ask about the issue that was raised already. So the number of prostitutions that have been reported decreased after the new legislation, because in Germany we had a big discussion whether we should use the so-called Nordic legislation model, in which the man who pays for sex is illegal, but not the lady who offers sex.
Mm.
She's not illegal. And after that, I've heard that the numbers went really down, and even the trafficking underground groups got some problems with financing their system. Is that true, or is that?
So it's a question about the anti-prostitution law in Sweden. Generally, in Sweden, the impression is that the law is good. That is the majority view, and but of course it does not get rid of the whole business. So there's still a lot of prostitution, but it's harder to see on the surface, and it's harder for the for like police and others to monitor it because it's criminalized. But I'm not an expert on the evaluation of the law. Let me continue here, and you will have more chances to interact here. But we have so much to cover this afternoon. So my question here, or my conclusion here, is we need a better way as a culture. And then I think we really need to go back to point zero, really start from the beginning, how to build a sexual ethic. And really start to ask the basic question, is there anything that is normal, that is good? And is there anything that is unnatural and wrong in terms of sex? Any given year in a population, so if we take Sweden, we will find so many different kinds of relationships and sexual activities. They are just a fact of reality. Monogamy, polygamy, polyamory, promiscuity, different sexual identities, prostitution, group sex, and all the way to pedophilia, necrophilia, dendrophilia, which is if you are sexually attracted to a tree. So a thing, not a living being, a tree. People who are aroused sexually and who sleep in their bed with wood or go out in the forest. Now this is very unusual, but there was an interview in the biggest Swedish newspaper with a 20-year-old girl who identified sexually with a tree. So, and the list could be much, 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 much longer, of course, with all the strange things we as human beings can engage in. And every individual and every culture needs some guidelines. What do we affirm, and where do we draw a line? What do we say, this is good, and where do we say, well, this is not really the way it should be. There's no way around it. You need to have some norm. you know, every year there are people sentenced in Sweden for having sex with animals or having sex with corpse. Okay, so one need to define some kind of sexual norms. Listening to the culture, here are four of the most common suggested criteria. This is the way we navigate in terms of sexuality. The most naive one is follow your heart. This is what so many young people are just encouraged. You should follow your heart. Okay? It does not help us very much. It's not much of a criteria because our hearts can be really strange and go astray in any direction. So then, of course, people say, well, follow your heart, but you are not allowed to hurt anybody. So as long as it does not hurt anybody, that's okay. But if you try to apply this criteria and say this is the only one, a lot of strange things happening. Because you will meet people say, well, I have sex with my dog and I didn't hurt it. And how would you define hurt? Is it a bleeding from the body, or what about pain in the soul? You know, so it's that's not enough. So people who have been thinking a little bit more, they say, well, as long as you follow your heart and you do not hurt anybody and you are consenting adults, Okay, there you go. So, not children, and not by force, and not animals, but consenting adults. But still, there is a lot of things. If you try to navigate with this, what about prostitution? I have consented for $1,000 to do something. Okay, so then people say, but follow your heart, do not hurt anybody. It's for consenting adults that care for each other. So it cannot be totally impersonal. It cannot be business. You need to care for each other. And you will be very hard-pressed to find anyone in Sweden saying anything beyond this. This is the strictest sexual ethic you will find in public in Sweden. But my question is, have people really thought this through? A married man with a mistress, and the two of them really care for each other? A grown-up daughter, 25 years old, with her father. It was recently a case, one in Germany, one in Norway. The daughter had several children with her father. And they both said, we are consenting, we are adults, we love each other. It does not seem to be enough. There's actually quite a number of problematic cases that would pass through this criteria. What is missing in this? I'm nothing against any of them, but they are incomplete. They are not enough. And in my analysis, what is missing is firstly, there is no connection to the uniting aspect of sex, that love is uniting two persons into one. And secondly, there is no connection to the body, to the biological facts of sexuality. What something is there for, the body, the biology. And my evaluation is that our problem is that we are not true to the reality of sex. We do not take the whole phenomenon of sex into account in our discussion. We are not true to the reality of sex. Before coffee in a few minutes, let me just move on from here. What we are missing here can be formulated out from natural law. After the coffee, we will go on to the Bible, but what is missing can be formulated out from natural law. The perspective that things in this world is designed has a purpose, and you don't actually need to believe in God in order to think in terms of things being designed. What is the meaning of my genitals? Of my sex organs? Of course, an atheist can ask that question, and biologically, there is an answer. There is a meaning, a design. It is there for some reason. It has a kind of specified function. Ray, what is that in English?
Acorn.
An acorn has the possibility of become a powerful oak, a big tree. Of course, things can come in the process destroying the potential, but it is designed to become an oak. And natural law is asking us the question, what are we as human beings designed for? What is sex designed for? What is the full reality, the full potential of sex, if everything is going right? What is the full potential of the acorn? It is to become an oak. Of course, things can come in and destroy this potential, but that's another. You can still think of the full potential that it is designed for. It is this. What is the full potential of our sexuality? And then I would say that the full potential of sexuality is procreation. Biologically, that is why it is there. This is the way that we multiply and the human race continues. So procreation is part of the full reality of sexuality. And secondly, to unite people. In all real love affairs where people are experiencing love, they want to express that in the uniting of the bodies. It's interesting to see in marriages where people are committed to each other, sex has this functioning of being the sign of their unity. And that is why, not in the open marriages, but in marriages where people are committed, infidelity is such a threat because it destroys the function that sex has as the sign of our unity, of our belonging. And that is a huge betrayal of the love that is between the man and the woman. So the full potential of sex is procreation, is to sign the unity between two persons, and then of course to experience passion and joy and pleasure. Okay, we take a break there. Our time is up, and after coffee, we will go on from this perspective and move on to a more specifically Christian understanding of what is the full potential of sexuality. But now it's coffee, and we meet again 3:30.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then, a lot of stuff here.
A lot of cake was.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. You have an interesting presentation.
Okay.
I take notes.
Okay, good.
At least this at least takes less space so you can put in more.
Yeah. Well, you'll stay soon.
Okay, or we can have a couple together now.
need to go back to my shelter.
Okay. I don't think I would know why this much better if I didn't go to sleep. So with some samples, that's my scripture.
Yeah.
And then every time I hear speakers come and say, I'm so grateful when Jesus died for me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. I became a Christian at university,
yeah.
And for me, the same thing, it's brilliant. Non-Christian friends just made me think about my faith, because... Like,
thanks to them, otherwise.
Yeah, it's good, it's good.
And what did you study?
Maths.
I did maths and physics engineering.
Okay.
So I think it was organized.
Yeah.
And why you're not using that?
I do use it in bits.
To count the money?
1, 2, 3.
I'm a statistician.
Okay.
So you went off maths to go to physics, I went off the other direction.
Okay.
So actually, yeah, I do. I use it in bits. So I use it occasionally to set up surveys and studies and analyze the spiritual situation of the country. When I was. I worked.
I've said, what's your name?
Paul.
What's
yours? I used to lecture in statistics, and when I was thinking about going out to the mission, I said, I'm not proposing myself because I think I can't work as a lecturer, or I'm fed up of working, but I feel my calling. I want you to kind of come back to Melbourne, you know, if you think this is the right time for you to push me forward. So no one told me about it. I'm quite open to that. And they were afraid on to encouraging me. It's a nice thing just to drop in.
That's fine.
If they want a question. Because obviously, as soon as you say you're a Christian worker,
in front of that chair,
well, the church or the level below the level of clean.
That is something as a Christian, you should let them know.
That's then where it puts you.
Kjenner du til det?
Ja, det gjør jeg.
Det er
fantastisk bra.
Ja.
Jeg kommer til å nevne honom spesifikt, men...
Er det en bok du anbefaler? Eller er den for spesiell?
Altså, jeg har lest bøker som bygger på den,
ja.
Derfor at den er... De säger att den är inte så kommunikativ, alltså den är innehållsmässigt fantastiskt bra.
Ja.
Men vi har i Sverige en katolsk nunna som har skrivit en bok som bygger på kroppens teologi. Men, ja, just det.
Vad heter den? Eller heter boken Kroppens teologi?
Ja, vad heter den? Nu står det stilla. Vad heter den boken nu?
Jag kan se musikaffinen.
Ja. Just det. På Arthurs bokförlag och gör alltså
är det kropp på svenska, är det kropp? Nej,
kropp.
Det är kropp. Det är kroppen.
Nej, kropp. Kroppen.
Ja, där prövar jag lite.
I don't bother you when I put the signs up, but then
No,
sure?
That's good.
Okay, sorry. It's kind of rude.
No, that's good. Yeah. I need the reminder.
Okay, thank you very much. And then I'm supposed to, at the end, 5 minutes at 3:25,
yeah,
we're over them to hand out the evaluation sheets.
Yes, yeah.
If that's okay.
Yeah?
Okay,
oh, yeah.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
This is the brother I was talking about.
Hello, good to see you.
Good to see you again.
That worked out well. Okay, it's 3:30, so we will start again. So, welcome back. We will continue our apologetics for sex.
Is it possible to ask a question about natural law, or is that not appropriate right now?
Remind your question. Remember your question, because we need to move forward. I will say one more thing about natural law, and then move on to the Bible. You remember the girl who was sexually attracted to trees, and who went out into the forest and also found a part of a tree to bring home to her bed. A lot of non-Christians would dismiss every thought about natural law in many areas of sex, saying we're just free to do whatever we want to do. But in this example, which is a real example, most people would agree that this girl is not experiencing the fullness of what sex is designed for. And even if one would not like to forbid her to do what she's doing, I think most, also non-Christians, would give us arguments which is very close to natural law arguments. What is something designed for? What is the actual meaning with? And saying, well, this girl, she's free to do this, but it's not really in line with the fullness of what sexuality is designed for, or is meant to be. It's not the full reality of sex. But we can come back to that. We will move in now to a more specifically Christian perspective on sexuality. And here we have some good news. We have a gospel in that sense, good news. The Christian perspective on sex is that the origin of sex is, of course, God, the Creator. And the foundational passages is Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And Genesis 1, verse 26 and 27 says that God created man in his image. As male and female, he created us. And he gave us the task of procreating, multiply, and fill the earth. So the sexual polarity between male and female is a God-given thing and is part of our being images of God. He has chosen to create one human race on an equal level, but then in two versions, male and female. And it's strongly underlined in the text that we are created in his image as male and female.
So that is not a small detail. It's foundational for the Christian understanding of the human being. This interesting complementarity is in God's design. And then God immediately tells the human beings to have sex. It's God's first words to humanity: have sex, multiply. So Christianity gives us an absolute demarcation against any form of Platonism, devaluating the body or looking down on sex, every form of Gnosticism, giving priority to the soul and saying the body is low or unimportant or evil. The New Testament affirms very clearly this perspective from creation. And Paul actually says that people forbidding marriage, and that is sexual expression, that is a message from the devil. That is a message from the devil. The message from God is that he has created us as physical bodily beings with a sexuality, as male and females, with the calling to be God's co-workers and to fill the earth. So the origin of sex is God. Secondly, the context for sex is love. Chapter 2 of Genesis, in a very playful and, in terms of genre, a very naive literary style, gives us this joyful picture of the garden and the man being created by God. And notice how God takes care of the bodily side. God is actively involved in forming the body of the man. And then it's underlined, in a world where everything is good because it comes from God, one aspect is not good. It's not good for man to be alone. And it's underlined the need for community and fellowship. It's a very dramatic event, because in a perfect world, where the man has fellowship with God, that is not enough. It's very provocative. God is not enough. Think of it. Not that anything is lacking within God, of course, but it's the Bible's way of telling us that God has created us as this kind of beings who are called to relate to God, but who are also called to relate to someone on our level. The animals are lower than us. God is infinitely higher than us. And we have an inbuilt need of standing alongside other human beings. So we have this need for companionship. And then God creates the woman and creates her out of the body of the man. So now the man can say, she is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, but still she's different. It's not a new male, but it's a female. And still they are connected. It's out from his own body. So again, we have this picture of equality, but also of distinction. And then we have God's words about his thought behind making a male and a female, a man and a woman, that they should be one. So we have a need of this lasting connection, to be connected to someone. Community and connection, that's other words for or aspects of love. So the whole context for us being male and female with a sexuality is the context of community, of connection, of love. And then the chapter ends very beautifully with, it says that the man and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. And of course it's not primarily about the lack of clothing,
I think the nakedness should be understood in terms of the last word of the sentence, no shame. They were really open for each other, not hiding, not ashamed. They had really a heart-to-heart relationship. So they were naked in a much deeper sense than just the lack of clothing. Thirdly, and this is, of course, in our culture, the controversial point. The place for sex is marriage. The key text in the Bible is God's explanation in Genesis 2:24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. That verse is quoted by Jesus when he is asked questions about marriage and divorce. He immediately goes back to both Genesis 1. Haven't you read that in the beginning God created them as male and female? And then he quotes chapter 2. And therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, and so on. So this is the starting point for Jesus when discussing issues of marriage and divorce and sexuality. So obviously, he thinks this is a key verse. And Paul quotes it in Ephesians 5 when he talks about husband and wife. And he says, here is a deep secret. Something here is mirroring Christ's relationship to the church. So no Christian can ignore Genesis 2. It's God's explanation just after he has created man and woman. Jesus quotes it when he discussed the issues. Paul quotes it. So this is the key verse. And what we have in the verse is a definition of marriage. And if we take the different components of the verse, we will find the following. The definition of marriage is a monogamous relationship. A man and his wife. It's not many men or many women. It's a man and his wife. It's a monogamous relationship. Secondly, it's a heterosexual relationship. It's a man and his wife. So it's not two men or two women. We will come back to that issue, of course. It's a relationship that starts with a change of social status. And I don't think we in our culture realize the forces of leaving his father and mother. In my culture, when people are 19 years old, they move away from home to live in a student dorm, and that's not a big thing, it's just a transition. But in antiquity, your highest priority was to honor your father and mother and to leave them and to gain a new first responsibility was a big social step. That was not a small thing. It was something that affected the social fabric. It was a change of social status to set up a new unity. It was supposed to be a lifelong relationship with lifelong fidelity. One should hold fast to and not let go or divorce, but hold fast to each other, the man to his wife. And this relationship is then completed in the sexual union. The two of them should become one flesh. So here's five components in the definition of marriage. Monogamous, heterosexual, a new social unity, which is ideally a lifelong unity, and it is confirmed in the sexual union. They become one flesh, symbolized in
the bodies becoming one, symbolizing the unity they now should create and develop between themselves. Just to make some more comments about the definition of marriage. Marriage here is seen as a covenant. The Hebrew terms for leave and hold fast, the biblical scholar says they're typically covenantal terms. The same terminology is used in God's covenant with Israel. In the book of Malachi, marriage is explicitly described as a covenant, the covenant of your youth and your wife by covenant. So enter into a marriage is to enter into a covenant. This marriage covenant is confirmed in the sexual union, not created by having sex. I meet quite a lot of Christians who think that marriage is established by having sex. So a man and a woman are having sex, and then they are married. I don't think that is the biblical position for several reasons. It's extremely impractical. If you take it seriously, a number of Swedes would have hundreds of marriage partners. Is that realistic? How do you deal with that? It's a totally stupid concept. In the Bible, no one is getting married by having sex. A man and a woman having sex, it's called fornication. It's porneia. So you are married by entering into a public covenant, which is then confirmed by the sexual union. I don't know if a number of you are pastors and are ordained to do marriages. But then you know, I'm not, but I've visited a number of marriages. So you have the question, do you want to love until death do? Yeah. And they say, yes, yes. I hereby declare you man and wife. There you have the covenant. There you have the marriage, which is then confirmed in the sexual union. We have committed ourselves to each other to become one, and we confirm that in the sexual union. The sexual union in itself is not creating a marriage. There were some reactions on this or questions? Yeah?
Yeah, but in 1 Corinthians it says that even the sexual union with a prostitute makes the two of them one flesh.
Yeah, but it does not say they are thereby married. But it says they... They are doing the thing that God has intended for marriage to signify the unity. But Paul is not saying they are becoming man and husband. And you can read if you read the Old Testament law, which Paul is referring to in the same chapter in several places, when a man and a woman are having sex without being married, it's not called marriage, but then they have to decide, should they marry as a consequence of this, or should they solve the situation in another way to pay the woman's father a certain price? But they are not married by having sex. So I think it's a misinterpretation of 1 Corinthians 6, where Paul is quoting this passage, but he's not saying they are getting married, but they are doing something that belonged to marriage, but they are doing it in a totally wrong context, a prostitute and a man paying for sex.
Just to back that up, it uses the word kaleo of the binding of the man to the prostitute, the unity aspect of sex.
Yeah.
It uses that same verb, a verse or two later, to talk about binding oneself to Christ. So it can't be marriage.
No.
Just back that what you're saying.
Okay, yeah, thank you. This covenant is in all cultures legally recognized. The marriage covenant is legally recognized, so it's a public, official covenant. I find it interesting that basically there is a universal definition of marriage. Of course, you think historically there's a lot of discussion about monogamous and polygamous marriages. But when it comes to other dimensions, there is a universal definition of marriage. And I mean this. You can go to any country in the world and ask anybody, are you married? And no one said, oh, married, I'm not really sure. Married, I don't know. Married, perhaps. It's an absolutely meaningful question in every culture. And it means that you have entered into an official, legally recognized covenant with someone. So a number of the aspects here are part of the universal understanding of marriage. In order to understand why the Bible limits the sexual expression to marriage, I think it's helpful to reflect on how to understand the sexual union. What is it to have sex with someone? I try to listen to the culture. What are people saying? What is it to have sex with someone? Well, some people go for the pleasure side. It's physical pleasure. It's an unusual, potent body massage. You know, it's filled with pleasure to have your back massaged or your foot massaged. Or this is just the most potent massage possible, and that's it. Don't make a big fuss about it. It's others would say, no, there's more to it. That's a very shallow view to limit it to the physical pleasure. This must be an expression of some sort of love, of communication, of connection, of touching each other on a somewhat deeper level. I don't care that much about who is massaging my foot, but I'm not that careless with whom I'm having sex. There needs to be something between the two of us. And then people define that, what that is in different way, but something must be there.
Do you define love as an emotion in this case?
Yeah, then it's a very very shallow use of the word love. Maybe I should have written connection, an expression of human connection or communication of some sort.
Or of emotional closeness or something.
Yeah, yeah. The third way to understand it is how people in serious love relationships understand it, that it is a sign of unity, that this is something unique between the two in the relationship. Now, if you live in relationship, and if you are in a marriage, for example, 1,000 of the things you do with your spouse, you do with other people. So you eat together, you travel together, you have different projects together, you laugh together, you discuss together. If you're a Christian, there are other Christians you pray together with. So all the things you do as man and wife, both of you individually are doing with a number of other people. Hopefully, as man and wife, you do it more and deeper together than you do with other people, but it's basically the same thing you're doing. Here, sex is a wonderful secret between the two to confirm and manifest the uniqueness of that relationship. It's a constant giving of each other what you promised with your mouth in the marriage. I will belong to you. You then signify that commitment and that belonging with sex. It's a covenantal sign that the couple can return to again and again to remind oneself and renew oneself in the commitment to each other. So it has a deep sign value. Now, in most marriages, sex is taking on that dimension. And that's why infidelity is such a catastrophe in most cases, regardless of if you're a Christian or not, because this is our sign. This is our secret. This threatens everything if you break away that. It does not threaten me if you have a coffee with someone or if you're doing this or that, but this threatens the covenant because you're doing something with the sign of the covenant, which symbolizes all other unity we have. Now, in this perspective, it makes sense why the Bible says that sex belongs to marriage. And I think, thinking of my own culture, a lot of people now, they have quite a huge number of shorter or longer sexual relationships, a number of one-night stands and so on. And then later on, they are meeting someone they really care about and they want to commit themselves and they get married. Now they have to transfer something that for many years has been a very selfish thing. This is me and my pleasure. Now that needs to be transferred into a kind of sacred symbol which stands for something totally different of long-term, unselfish commitment to another person. The opposite of the way it was used and what it symbolized in an earlier part of my life. And here I think we are doing something quite destructive with sexuality. Interestingly, when we are having sex, our whole body is giving this signal of connecting, of bonding, of uniting. You can find a lot of material about a chemical substance in our body, oxytocin. I don't know how you say it in English. It's a substance that when a woman gives birth to a child or breastfeed a child, her body will be filled with that because it helps her to connect and commit to the baby. And when we are having sex, the same substance is released in the brain and creates this bond. So our whole body is giving this signal of bonding, of belonging to. So here you can say the chemistry of your body is pointing in the direction of the Christian understanding of love. This is a signal of the unity. Why relate sex to marriage and to keep sex within marriage only? Two principal reasons. The first is this reason I've been talking about. The sexual act expresses unity. It is our deepest language. It is, you can say it's our deepest body language. We say with our body something, namely, I want to be with you. I want to belong to you. I want to be united with you. And the point here is that we should be true
with our bodies. We shouldn't say with our bodies what we are not prepared to say with our mouth. We should be coherent. So first, when we are really prepared to say, I'm committed to you for the rest of my life, I want to belong to you, I want to enter into a covenant with you, I want to unite with you, it's first at that moment we should also say it with our body. So we are coherent, speaking truth with our mouth and with our body. So in one sense, sexuality is not fully true without commitment, because the act itself is symbolizing a unity. And the second reason is that the sexual act procreates. We should be willing to accept the fruits of our sexual acts. And children are entitled to their mother and their father. So we should be prepared to receive children. And children is, of course, a long-term responsibility. They need their mother and their father. So this is the two principal reasons. And then there are two pragmatic reasons. There are health reasons. And this is not a minor thing today. It's quite a big thing. But for people who have only one sexual partner, the whole area of sexually transmitted disease just dissolves. It's a non-issue. So that's a more pragmatic reason. It's more healthy for you. And the second pragmatic reason is for relationship reasons. And here I have some statistics. They have been doing some research quite recently in the US, which is showing that people who is not having many sexual partners, they form more stable relationships. I will give you some quotes here. Here's a study from Cornell University from 2012, so it's quite recently. And here is the summary of the study. Women who have sex early in a relationship are more likely to be dissatisfied later with the quality of the relationship. Men who delayed sex also reported higher levels of commitment and less conflict, but the effect was greater for women. Early sex in a relationship was also associated with living together sooner and less satisfying marriages. Interesting. So if you start the sexual life early, there is less satisfaction in the relationship later. I think here is an interesting dynamic most people misses, that to start to have sex, it's a shortcut to something very interesting. But it easily distracts us from really forming a stable relationship and exploring the person instead of exploring the bodies. The great thing with the Christian perspective is that it calls us to get to know the person and explore the person and establish the relationship. And when you know that this relationship is what you want to continue, then you are given a wonderful gift to strengthen that relationship. But today people start from the other end with sex, which of course give a lot of glow to the relationship. But maybe the other aspects are not that good. Here is another study from the University of Virginia, and that's from last year. According to the study, men and women who had premarital sex with only their future spouse reported having a stronger relationship than those who did not. Additionally, women who had fewer sexual partners prior to marriage reporting having higher quality. And here's a third example. It's two sociologists, and they have published a book, Premarital Sex in America, How Young Americans Meet, Mate, and Think About Marrying. And it was commented in an open ad in New York Times, 2011. And the comment about the book was this. Their research looks at sexual behavior among contemporary young adults and finds a significant correlation between sexual restraint and emotional well-being. That's interesting. Two sociologists finding that sexual restraint and emotional well-being, there was a significant correlation between monogamy and happiness and between promiscuity and depression. This correlation is much stronger for women than for men. Female emotional well-being seems to be tightly bound to sexual stability, which may explain why overall female happiness has actually drifted downward since the sexual revolution. I told you, don't make fallen male sexuality the norm. It's disastrous for both male and females. So in conclusion, the Christian faith and the biblical teaching say yes to the unifying aspect of sex and gives that a high place. It says yes to reproduction, of being co-workers to God, and it says yes to pleasure, to bodily beauty and to pleasure and to passion. It's actually true to the full reality of sex in a way other contemporary perspectives are not. It is true to the full reality of sex. Okay, I stop there for comments and questions, and then we will later on move into the whole area of homosexuality, and we need some time to that too. But questions or comments? Yes.
Thanks. Brilliant stuff so far. I appreciate it. When you say Christian, do we need to nuance that claim by saying acknowledging that some forms of Christianity have officially different doctrines on sexuality than others?
You're thinking of.
I guess I'm thinking of the de-emphasis of pleasure, for example, in some streams of Catholic theology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Traditionally, in some evangelical commentary as well, might be fair to say.
So it's a I'm obliged to repeat the questions for the recordings here. So it's a question about the Christian faith. Maybe I should. Define that, because there are differences within different traditions. And I do agree, the traditional Roman Catholic understanding of sex has emphasized procreation and diminished the other aspects, highlighting one aspect. Some more pietistic evangelical traditions have not made much room for pleasure and passion and fun in this area and in other areas. So we have many things in the Christian history that does not express a healthy or balanced view on sex. So maybe I should have written the biblical view to be on safe grounds. the French atheist, oh, I miss his name, has written Handbook for Atheists. He has
Michel Onfray.
He has really collected all bad statements from the Christian history on sex and on the body and on happiness and on pleasure and so on. And unfortunately, there is a lot. Because so much of Christian thinking was influenced by the Greek thinking and the Neoplatonism, which looked down on the body and looked down on sex. We should notice that the Bible has a wonderful poetic book on love and sensuality and romance and sex, the Song of Songs, celebrating this aspect of God's creation. Okay, anything more? Yeah?
Probably you come back to that, but the polygamy of the Old Testament people, like even the patriarchs, seem to have more than one wife. So, and there were even rules how to accept a new wife and so on when the brother died and so on. So was that also meant for sexual union or only for caring for that wife and so on? But probably you come back to that anyway.
No, I will not come back to the issue of polygamy. So let me say something shortly. It's obvious that we have polygamy in the Old Testament, and there are some regulations in the law. I understand them the same way as Jesus understood the divorce laws, that it was a reality. And it had to be handled in order to diminish further evil. The overall biblical perspective is very clear from the beginning. What is God's intention? One man and one woman united in a lifelong relationship. The first polygamous relationship we have in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 4 with Lamech, who is described as a man going against God, where God is giving just judgment, revenged, avenged seven times. Lamech is avenging 70 times, so 10 times more than God. So he's putting himself above God. And as one of the ways he is putting himself above God, making himself God, is that he is the first one in the Bible who takes two wives. And the author of Genesis does not need to make a comment, by the way, this was against God's will. Every intelligent reader understands that from chapter 1 and 2. This is part of fallen human man. And then when you continue to read in the Old Testament, you can see that those who took more than one wife, in nearly all the texts, it only creates problems for them. And again, the authors does not need to tell us this was a bad move to do that, because you know it from Genesis, and you know it from the story of Lamech, and you can see the consequences for Abraham or for Jacob, and you see it in terms of Solomon and all his wives, which is not a polygamy in general sense, because there is all the the status and power play of being a king, and show, you know, no man needs 900 wives. How potent you are! You know. So that's something completely different. It's showing your wealth and your status. But it destroyed him. It led him away, all the women. So, yes, there was sin in the Old Testament because it was sinners. The law regulated some of it, but the overall perspective in the Bible is monogamy. One man and one woman is God's design. So, Muslim societies, a lot of men have up to four wives, and if a Muslim converts, should he divorce three of his wives? That has been a common problem in mission history. Missionaries coming to Africa, not to Muslim cultures, but to tribal cultures there, and
polygamy was just natural. What to do? Now, that situation needs to be handled with great care. We as Christians cannot adjust our ideal, which is the monogamous marriage. But when things have gone wrong, you need wisdom not to make the situation even more destructive. And there are a lot of examples from Christian missionary history where a converted man has been forced to divorce some of his wives, just keeping the first wife, throwing them out into misery socially and financially and so on, and with no one taking care of them. So there are social aspects on how to handle this, where you need wisdom. When a thing has gone wrong, you cannot always make everything right, but you have to go with some of the consequences of people's choices. So in my view, in a missionary situation, sometimes you have to live with a factual reality of one man with several wives, but in the next generation that problem needs to be solved. So it cannot continue. Yes?
So you meant to say it's okay if that person converts to Christianity, he can keep his wives, but his children, next generation has to change.
I have too little experience of this. So I would like to talk more to people who have been on the ground with real persons how to deal with this in the right way. So I'm mainly saying I think we need to be open to that possibility. Since they are married, since the alternative may be that if he divorces some of his wives, they are forced into prostitution, or because socially their lives will be totally destroyed. And the witness for the gospel will be very strange. My husband became a Christian and my life was destroyed. So it's a very complicated situation.
Is there a story from the Bible you can support your view?
I think you can argue for it in two different ways. The first way is that even though the Old Testament clearly says that monogamy is God's ideal, when people chose to live in polygamous relationship, God did not force them to divorce their wives, but actually taking responsibility for them. And secondly, a more general perspective on we need to deal with real persons in real situations. What is the lesser evil in this situation? There is no perfect solution. What then to do? And when the missionaries I have talked with who has been dealing with this situation, they tell some horrible stories when Christian leaders have been too harsh trying to establish the ideal into a situation with a number of wrong choices, previous wrong choices. Where the challenge will be for us to keep the biblical teaching, the ideal, very clear, but at the same time deal with real human beings, real situations, imperfect circumstances, which we have not created, but we need to relate to, and we need to help people. So we need the blend of truth and grace that Jesus had. He never adjusted God's ideal, but he managed to relate to people in all different situations in a graceful way.
For me, the way I'm interpreting what you are saying is, let's say I killed 8 people before I become Christian, and today I became Christian, and tomorrow I continue to kill people. It is the similar things. You are not helping that person to repent. And in Islamic marriage, when we say person has four wives plus they are into mutual marriage, all those things. If that person is not recognizing that I have been sinful, I was worshiping a false god, now I need to repent and come back to God, then that person is not a Christian yet. So that person has to give up where he is. Maybe practical application might be problems, but even when they are married, for example, I don't know how much you know about Islam, but for example, in England, we do have people who have four wives, three wives. First wife is the legal marriage, and second, third, and fourth one is the kind of in girlfriend position, so they don't have any legal rights. I have an imam friend who become Christian, and the moment he became Christian, he knew the life he was in was wrong, and he had to change everything. He didn't throw anyone away, but he told them, I'm sorry, I'm Christian from now, I cannot have any sexual relationship with you, but I will look after you. So I think we have to follow what scripture says, and you've been teaching that one man, one woman.
Sure.
One man for one woman. That's God's ideal, and we read the Old Testament, we look at people around us, and we see God's ideal is not matching with my ideal, and I'm playing with his ideal view. I think that's pretty dangerous, but I'm not sure. Like it's kind of the way I am understanding what you are saying. It's you find right to encourage someone to abuse God's grace, and that's wrong for me.
That's wrong for me too. We shouldn't abuse God's grace. Absolutely not. At the same time, you cannot compare polygamous marriage with murder. So I don't buy that.
For that sin is sin.
Well, there is also difference between different sins. All sins are equal in one aspect. It breaks our relationship with God. But sins are also hugely different. So the difference between having a hateful feeling and actually killing a person, that's an immense difference. Both for me, if you hate me or you kill me, and for God. So they are similar in one respect, that they are sin and creates a guilt, but they are also hugely different in what kind of sin it is. So I think we need to make clear that distinction. I totally agree that we need to repent from our sins, and when I talked, I was thinking about some missionary situations in Africa in the early 20th century. Of course, the social and economical situation is very different in the 21st century in Western Europe. Maybe some of the practical situations can be handled different. We cannot. I'm not saying we should just copy one way of handling the situation. You are suggesting here something interesting, that that the man in a polygamous marriage says, I was wrong marrying you. I will now see myself only married to my first wife, but I will take care of you. I will take responsibility for you, so not throwing them out on the street. If I understood you right. Yeah. Okay. Now, that is a very, very interesting way of handling a complex and complicated situation, which I think very much do justice to both the God's ideal and to have take care for people who are a kind of victim of your choice. I would say in the Old Testament,
it is again and again looked upon as marriage, but it is a marriage that has deviated from the ideal. They are not viewed as not married, but it's obviously not in sync with God's ideal. 30 years ago, this aspect was not a big big discussion, not at all in the church, and not that big in culture either. But we have seen a rapid change, and now this is one of the most hotly debated issues, of course, both outside the church and inside the church. What to say about homosexuality? It's a minefield, and it's so difficult to address it, because what is said is not what is heard, and it makes it very difficult to have meaningful dialogues in this area. An ethical statement like, "I think homosexual relationships are wrong," and meant just as an ethical statement, is interpreted as an anthropological statement, "I don't accept you," which is a totally different statement. And the whole public discourse in this area is in this way now, that any ethical statement about homosexual relationship is interpreted as an anthropological undermining of the person as such. And this makes it extremely difficult to address. The change in our culture is very dramatic. When I grew up, still in Sweden, the majority position in the culture was that homosexuality is a kind of psychological disorder. And it was, of course, defined as a psychological illness in the official documents. Gradually, more and more people started to say, it looks like a number of people cannot live sexually in any other way. So it's a kind of emergency solution for some. It's not equivalent to a male-female relationship, but we have to accept for a few, this is their only possibility. So, okay. We move to that, from that to the perspective that this is an equivalent variation. You cannot say it's unnatural or anything less than a male-female relationship. Two, people today saying it's a superior lifestyle. Gays have more fun. This is the ultimate freedom. And today we are in somewhere in between those two perspectives. For us as Christians to address this situation is difficult for a number of reasons. One of the reasons being that the term homosexuality and the whole concept of a homosexual identity is not part of our perspective on the human being. Not that we deny that people experience that that identity, but we are not labeling people according to identities. It's important to see that the term homosexuality was coined 1869 by a Hungarian journalist. No one used it before that. It's the first article where he coined it, homosexuality. And it came into the academic literature 1886.
Do you mean homosexuality or homosexual?
Homosexuality. Before that, it was called sodomy, and it was used about the action, not about the person.
or it was called unnatural fornication. So it was just an individual action. It was not said about a certain kind of person. Now the whole identity thing of a homosexual identity has become in the forefront and is so important for many people. The problem here for us discussing the whole issue is that we do not look at people as straight or gay. That is not our perspective. We do not define humanity in those categories. The Christian perspective is a universal, it's an inclusive perspective. Everyone is created in the image of God, created as male and female. Everyone is fallen into sin, and everyone is called back to God through Jesus Christ. Now, and then our view of the human being stops there in terms of the general picture. Our individual desires or and abilities or problems or dysfunctions does not define us as human beings. We all have desires and abilities and dysfunctions and strange sexual urgings, but that is not put up on this higher level of defining who we are. We are not denying those aspects of ourselves, but it's not our identity. So the Christian faith has a very different perspective on the human being than the common perspective today, where the sexual identity is placed on par with you being male or female. And then you're this type of male, a gay male, or you're this type of female. So what we would view as individual desires has moved up to the level of an identity on par with being male and female. This complicates the discussion. It is also complicated by the fact that our culture loves clichés, especially in this area. And I think it's a hopeless area because people have bought into so many clichés. And we need to deconstruct them. And I'm constantly amazed listening to the highest politicians, the most well-known journalists, using those clichés again and again and again. So, just quickly, 7 very common clichés. We could have many more. This is a question of human dignity and human rights. No, it's not. It's an ethical question. Equal value does not mean all actions are equally right. We all agree that pedophilia is wrong. A pedophile has the same value as I have as a human being. So, ethical question, what is right and wrong doing sexually, is not an anthropological question, who is valuable and who is less valuable. It's genetically caused and unchangeable, and therefore must be lived out. Well, it's not genetically caused, we'll come back to that. But if it were, it would not solve the ethical question. Genetics does not decide ethics. If they can show that aggression has an genetic component, it does not make violence right suddenly. So that's two different questions. What is the genetic background and what is the right action? It's found in nature, and therefore it's natural. Well, nature is not our ethical norm. In nature, everything happens. Animal
eat each other. The black spider have sex with the male spider and then kills him. But you cannot take ethical information from nature. Love can never be wrong. True. Love is never wrong. Love meaning doing good, being compassionate, caring for another person. Love is never wrong. True. But sexual acts can be wrong. A lot of love should not be expressed sexually. My love for my parents, my love for my children, my love for my brothers, my love for my friends. It's good, but it should not be expressed sexually. So we need to define in what relationships should love have a sexual expression. I'm entitled to my own sexuality. True. No one can demand your sexuality. It's yours. But our sexuality is not without limits. Everyone needs to discuss and think through, how should I live out my sexuality? It's my sexuality. But there's still the ethical question, what is a right and what is a wrong sexual action? It's about compassion. Honestly, you cannot say to someone who has a same-sex attraction, you need to live in abstinence the whole of your life. If you're compassionate and you realize sex is important, and therefore you need to affirm that people live out their sexuality. Yeah, compassion is a very important thing, and we should be compassionate. But again, compassion does not solve the ethical question. When I'm walking through a slum area and I see a mother with a small child, and I ask her, how do you survive? And she says, I steal. It's my only chance to help my child. I fully understand her choice. And of course, I feel compassion about the situation. But it does not solve that ethical question. Is it right to steal? And my judgment would be long-term, we need to find another way for you to solve this situation. And it is the same with sexuality. That I have compassion for someone does not in itself solve the ethical question. I've been told by Christians, I've prayed about it and I have peace, and therefore I pursue a same-sex relationship. That's good. We as Christians, of course, should pray about it, and it's a nice feeling if we feel peace from God. But in itself, that's not how we solve theological questions. I've talked to Jehovah's Witnesses and some Mormons, and they say, I've prayed, I feel peace over it. Okay. But there is more to be brought into the discussion. What about the Word of God? What about truth here, regardless of our individual feelings at the moment? So the whole question needs to be lifted to another level of discussing the real issue. What is a right sexual behavior? Shortly, just to make some comments about some of the factual sides. I think we all have heard old figures about 10% of the population having same-sex attraction. That has been disconfirmed many, many, many times. I found it interesting. Camille Paglia, a lesbian academic and activist, she writes this. As a teacher, 23 years, most of which were spent in art schools, I've been struck by the rarity, not the frequency, of homosexuality. From the start of my media career, I attacked a much-tooted activist claim that 10% of the population is gay, which was always a distortion of Kinsey's finding that 10% had some homosexual experience over their lifetime. Tracking my students, acquaintances, and the world in general, I guess the number hovered at 3%, and recent surveys ranging from 1 or 2 to 4% have borne this out. The 10% figure
repeated by the media was pure propaganda, and it made me, as a scholar, despise gay activists for their unscrupulous disregard for the truth. And in most surveys, it is somewhere between 1 and 4% in different countries. Of course, the percentages here does not solve the ethical question. It's not right or wrong because of how many percent, but it's still important to have a right picture. In terms of the causes, there is no full picture. We don't know why we develop the kinds of sexualities we develop. We don't have a full picture. But it is clear that it's not genetically caused. And it's actually one study done in Sweden, in Stockholm, at Karolinska, that has borne that out. A 2010 study of Swedish twins, so one egg twins, identical twins. Among 21 pairs of male identical twins, where one twin was gay, it was only in 7 cases, 9.8%, that the other twin was also gay. So there is no direct genetical causation. So homosexuality is not genetically caused, but due to genetic factors, there may be increased propensity, which is different from direct genetic causation. So 9.8% is a higher figure than 1 to 4 for the general population. But it's still not 100% as it is with the color of your eyes or the color of your skin and so on. So it's not genetically caused. Here's a long text, an Australian scholar, a New Zealand scholar. 8 major studies of identical twins in Australia, the US, and Scandinavia, it's this study, during the last 2 decades, all arrive at the same conclusion: gays were not born that way. At best, genetics is a minor factor, says Dr. Neil Whitehead. Whitehead worked for the New Zealand government as a scientific researcher for 24 years, then spent 4 years working with the United Nations and International Atomic Energy Agency. Identical twins have the same genes or DNA. They are nurtured in equal prenatal conditions. If homosexuality is caused by genetics or prenatal conditions and one twin is gay, the co-twin should also be gay. Because they have identical DNA, it ought to be 100%, Dr. Whitehead notes. But the studies reveal something else. If an identical twin has same-sex attraction, the chances the co-twin has it are only about 11 for men and 14 for women. So that's slightly higher than in the Swedish study. Because identical twins are always genetically identical, homosexuality cannot be genetically dictated. No one is born gay, he notes. The predominant things that create homosexuality in one identical twin and not in the other have to be post-birth factors. So like the 10%, the genetic factor is a kind of myth that it is genetically caused.
Where is that?
that quotation is taken from I can give you it's from a website where you then have a note to all those studies, so I can give you then a website.
Did he also consider the epigenetic variant? Because it's a very recent hypothesis that homosexuality is transferred epigenetically by activation of certain genes. So male embryos have switched on the wrong sex attraction genes inherited from her mother, so to say. And that also explains why homosexuality appears in every generation again and again. There is no empirical evidence, as far as I know, but this is the most favored theory right now among gay activists, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember if he is commenting on that.
And in my view, the key thing here is not the causation. And we need to be open to a deepening understanding of the human body and of psychological development and so on. But regardless of that picture, we will still be confronted with the ethical issue. How should we then live? What should we do with what has been given to us through nature and through nurture? And then there is this third element. We have a choice on how to act with what was given to us, regardless of exactly how this picture will be. Yes?
Also, my reading of the gay activists' manuals, if you like, is that they were aware, back in the 1980s, they were aware that you are not born gay, but it's an extremely effective ramrod which to barge through with your particular ideology. If you can say some people are born black and some people are born gay,
yeah,
it trumps all other arguments. So it was deliberate tactic rather than a scientific fact, and they knew it to be so at the time. But they want to be able to equate being born gay as being born black,
yeah,
same minority.
Mm. So it's been very effective in changing our culture, even though it was false.
Have you got a good article or several on that subject?
The subject that Alexander wrote? Not on the top of my head, but maybe...
Jeffrey Satanova's book is good.
Which one?
Jeffrey Satanova.
Yeah.
American psychiatrist. Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth. Looks at the campaign to change public awareness.
Yeah.
Tactics like that. It's one of the best I would know. And Glyn Harrison's lectures here as well. Glyn Harrison's lectures at ELA.
What is the gay manual for activism? But the best one is Arthur Hall by Manson and somebody, I forgot what it is, but published in the 1980s.
Yes,
in America.
Yeah,
that's the one that's been quite open about the tactics.
So let's move on to the ethical question. How to evaluate. Sexual behavior and sexual lifestyles and sexual actions. And as Christians, I think we can give arguments both from natural law and from the Bible. And arguments which points in the same direction. If we take the concept of natural law, thinking about what something is designed for or intended for, there is three dimensions which is relevant for this issue. It's of course obviously that physically man's and woman's body belong together sexually. It's only a man and a woman who can be united sexually in a for the body natural way. Two women cannot be united at all, and two men cannot be united in a for the body natural way. So physically, it's an obvious fact that a man's body and a woman's body belongs together, and our sexual organs are designed for each other. Biologically, sexuality and reproduction is connected, and homosexual relationships are in this area, not in other areas, but in this area, they are biological sterile. Of course, homosexual couples now are having children, but that is by borrowing from the heterosexual world, and it's not the couple themselves that are having children, even though they take care of children and becomes socially and emotionally and legally the parents, but it's still not the two of them having the child, but they are borrowing from one of the opposite sex. And psychologically, homosexual relationships lack the complementarity of male and female, which is a complementarity that we constantly affirm in all other circumstances. In Sweden, this is so important of have both men and women in politics, in boards, corporate boards, in every aspect. And the argument is always, it's better because we complement each other and we bring different things to the table. We look at the world different, and it's a more interesting mix to have both men and women. But there is then one exception that people say it does not matter in terms of the sexual relationship. They want to ignore this psychological dimension. These are the three factors which is behind the fact that most cultures have had a negative attitude towards homosexuality. Even though we can see it, it's there all the way through history. Some cultures have been very affirmative of it. But still, a majority of human cultures and human religions have been negative. Not because they've studied the Bible, but because they have made this kind of reflection of the body, of biology, of the complementarity. For us as Christians, of course, the biblical text will be crucial, and I will make some comments of that on the text before we open up for discussion. There are five groups of biblical texts, and in my view, people are structuring them nearly always in the wrong way, because they are usually structured in a chronological order, which in my view is a catastrophe. I think the biblical material should be structured this way. There are five groups of biblical texts. The most important text is the affirmative text of Genesis 1 and 2, affirmative of God's will and design of human beings, male and female. Secondly, we have the text in Romans chapter 1, where Paul is dealing with God's wrath over sin, and he mentions same-sex relationships as examples of sins. Thirdly, we have the sin catalogs in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and in 1 Timothy chapter 1. These three group of texts are the crucial texts that decides, in my view, for the Christian, our position. And then in addition, we have two other groups of text, and that is the Mosaic Law, Leviticus chapter 18 and chapter 20. And then we have at least two stories in the Old Testament, in Genesis 19 and Judges 19. And in my view, it is a point of making a distinction between those three texts and those two texts. Not to say that we easily can dismiss those texts or that they should be without value. They are not, and we should not dismiss them. But as Christians, we read the Bible in a certain way. And it's natural to start with creation and then to look at the apostles' application of the biblical teaching. And then we look to the law of Moses. In my view, the problem, if you start to look with, and the stories, if you start to look with the stories and with the law of Moses, things become very complicated and messy, because obviously we as Christians are not very strict with all the details of the law of Moses, but we know it has a specific place in redemptive history. So that's why I think this is a better way of reading it.
Genesis 1 and 2. Humans are created in the image of God, created in two versions as male and female, and sex is for procreation. Chapter 2, our bodies are designed by God, sex is for making male and female one flesh. A wonderful balance of procreation and unity. Male and female coming together as God's co-workers and as forming a loving unity. That is the basic perspective. All the limits and boundaries in the rest of the Bible is based on an affirmation of Genesis 1 and 2. And think of it, the rejection of the idols in the Old Testament is based on the affirmation of the one and only living God of Israel. It's not just a negation, you should not do that. That negation is based on the affirmation of God. And in the same way, the rejection of different sexual action is based on the affirmation of Genesis and God's design, which is marriage. And all the negative statements in both the Old and the New Testament of you should not do this or that sexually is based on an affirmation of this is God's design. You should do this, and therefore you cannot do this or this or this. When we come to Romans, a lot of theologians today say that we need to interpret Paul in a new way. That Paul was not rejecting same-sex relationships because they were same-sex. That's not the problem, according to the new interpretation, but because it was connected to idolatry or to promiscuity or to abuse. And it is those three aspects that Paul is denouncing, not the same-sex aspect. Because, they say, in his time, same-sex relationships were basically associated with idolatry and promiscuity and abuse. And behind this new interpretation is often the argument that Paul did not know what we know today of loving, committed, long-term same-sex relationships. So Paul did not know. And when I've studied why the Lutheran Church changed its stand on marriage in Sweden, this was one of the basic arguments. Paul did not know. But it's obvious that in antiquity, people knew about committed, long-term, faithful, same-sex relationships. It's there, for example, in Plato's Symposium, where which is a long dialogue between different philosophers discussing love and relationships. And Aristophanes at one place says this, they, and that is two men, continue with one another throughout life, desiring to join together and to be fused into a single entity and to become one person from two. So here you have a long-term, committed, marriage-like relationship. So that was not unknown in antiquity. It's Plato in his dialogue Symposium. And the great thing with you can download Plato's stuff freely on the internet. You can easily find the Symposium. So actually in antiquity there was of course a lot of promiscuity and idolatry and abuse, but there were also same-sex, committed, loving, long-term relationships. There is a lot of material being assembled now, which it's a shame that it was not that well known 15 years ago. Because so much of the new interpretation is built upon this assumption they did not know. Among the Jewish community in antiquity, they had a totally unified view on homosexual relationships. Eusephus and the Jewish philosopher Philo and other Jewish writers all rejected same-sex relations. And one of the best presentations, I think, of this whole issue is Robert Gagnon's The Bible and Homosexual Practice. And he goes through a lot of the material of what did the Jews say about homosexual relationships.
And he also has a very big website.
He has a big website with a lot of material. He is, the leading scholar in this area of the biblical view on homosexuality. In terms of the text in Romans, and if we go to the direct text in Romans 1, which is the most important New Testament text, maybe we should, just so we know what we are talking about. Here is the full context. It's Romans 1, verse 18, to the end of the chapter. And in order to understand Paul's reasoning, one actually needs, I think, to read the whole passage, because the verses here, verse 24, 25, and 26, is part of a very important overall argument Paul is giving. So here is the text. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even the women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed shameful acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their error. Furthermore, just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind, so that they do what ought not to be done. They become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, no love, no mercy. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they do not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. So here is the full argument of Romans 1. Four observations. The overall logic of this passage is that the sin of man is an inversion of reality, turning reality upside down, inside out. Worshipping creation instead of the Creator, the mortal instead of the immortal. And left to ourselves, our whole lives will be inverted, will be upside down. So that's the overall perspective Paul has on us as fallen human being. We are rebels against God, and we invert the human being, dethroning God, putting ourselves at the center, turning everything upside down. The function of verse 24 to 28 for Paul's argument is that he describes what ought not to be done. And altogether there is 21 different sins, and no one can claim to be innocent. So this is not about certain individuals or certain people or certain groups. This is about us. And it's not a specific situation like in the temple or in a worship situation. It's very general about things that ought not to be done. And he starts this whole presentation with homosexual relationships. And in my view, not because it's worse than the other things in the list, but because of pedagogical reasons. It's a very vivid and strong illustration of the turning everything upside down, inside out. So he elaborates on same-sex relationships. They illustrate his main point. When he is writing this, it is like he's having Genesis 1 and 2 open and meditating over it. There is a lot of echoes in Romans 1 of Genesis 1 and 2. A lot of references to creation. He talks about since the creation of the world. He says that we started to serve created things instead of the Creator. He talks about the images. And that we worship images. We who are created in the image of God and should worship God. So he links with images. He names birds and animals and reptiles. That's the three categories in Genesis 1. He talks about what is natural and what is unnatural. So he makes a lot of references to Genesis. And this is written by a Jewish author. And we know that all Jewish thinkers in antiquity strongly opposed homosexual behavior. Now, if you take those four observations into consideration, the new interpretation of Paul is totally unlikely, in my view. He is absolutely giving a general condemnation of us as human beings, of us as rebels, and he's seeing homosexual behavior as one of many, many, many behaviors that are opposing God's design. So I have a hard time understanding those theologians who prefer the new interpretation. I don't think it's at all credible. And I think it's quite clear that Paul had a negative view towards same-sex relationships as a principle, because it was against creation and the created order. Now, we could have looked at, if we have had more time, we could have looked at 1 Corinthians, where he is actually referring back to Leviticus, so we cannot dismiss Leviticus. Paul is coining a phrase by taking two words from the Greek translation of Leviticus and coining it into a new word, and he's putting homosexual behavior in the list of sins that excludes people from the kingdom of God. So, as I see it, the Bible has a coherent picture of rejecting same-sex behavior. I have a lot of more material, but I think I stop there just to invite you for some questions or objections or reflections. So the question is about, for example, castration of pedophiles. Chemical castration. I would be open for that on a principle level, but I would like to talk to people who know more about it. It's of course about helping a person with a problem, if you take a pedophile, and about safeguarding innocent children.
And what is the best way to do that? And I know too little to make an informed comment about it. So a very interesting question about the relationship between a moral judgment and the legal situation. In Sweden, homosexual behavior was decriminalized in 1944. And there were no protests from the Christians. And I'm very happy with that kind of laws. I'm for a free society. And I think there's many, many areas we cannot go in and legislate. So I think we should have a free society. In terms of same-sex marriage, that is a very different issue. And I was very public in opposing the same-sex marriage in Sweden. Because that is not a freedom issue. That is an issue of how should we define marriage. And every culture needs to have a definition. It's just a question of what kind of definition. And I think the traditional definition, one man and one woman, who are adults, who are not at the moment married, and that are not closely related, they have the right to marry. I think that's a good definition, better than the new definition we now have, where the gender or the sex aspect has been dismissed. I think there are some really good arguments for a secular state to keep the traditional marriage definition, and that is that the heterosexual relationship provides something that no other relationship can provide, namely the future for society. And that's not a minor thing, that is not a detail. The next generation, that is absolutely crucial for society. It's not a small thing. And only the heterosexual, a male-female relationship, can provide the next generation. Therefore, it is in the interest of the state to help the next generation. And one of the primary thing with marriage is procreation and then the upbringing of the next generation. So I think a secular state is perfectly legitimized in saying, oh, here we have a special relation, male-female, and for that special relationship, we have a special institution. It's called marriage. You are free to live whatever way you want to live. But for this special relationship, we have a special institution, marriage, with a special purpose to taking care of the next generation, to safeguard the right of children to know and be related to their biological origin, their father and their mother. That's a right of the child, and we as a state want to protect that right. So I make a big difference between the general law, should you be allowed to live a promiscuous life or have same-sex relationships and so on. Yeah, I'm for a free society. How should we define marriage? That's a completely different issue. And I think there are good arguments for the traditional. So the question is about all the new technologies for procreation, which makes it not necessary any longer with one male and one female. Yeah, that's true. We have a lot of new possibilities. But just because something is possible, it's not the same as it's right. So we still need to make ethical decisions. There are no new possibilities that erase the child's right to their parents. And I think the gay community dismisses the child aspect. So children becomes the right of adults, and
And children are taken away from their biological origin and from their right to, when possible, grow up with those two beings who gave them their lives. And that is a youth thing. So I don't think technology is solving all the issue. Unfortunately, I've read a sign here saying our time is up. So I guess we have to finish here.